I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon sponsors. If you'd like to become a Patreon sponsor yourself for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, just go to bodybuildinglegendsshow.com, which is our official website, and you'll see the link to become a Patreon sponsor in the upper right-hand corner. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we are going to go back to the magazines. We're going to do some more magazine reading. I was not able to secure a guest. Seems like we're in a lull right now as far as finding guests for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I've been out there trying, but nobody is responding. So I've got a ton of great magazines to read, so I thought I'd go back and read some magazines. In this episode, we are going to focus on the Muscle Mag International magazines that were created by Bob Kennedy. He started the magazine back in 1974. It was one of the most popular magazines in the 1980s. And the unique thing about Bob Kennedy's Muscle Mag was that they did not cater to any particular organization. So, of course, the Weider magazines would only cover the IFBB, and then later on they would cover the NPC competitions, which were both connected, and they were both under the IFBB banner. And then Strength and Health and Muscular Development would only cover the AAU competitions when the AAU and the NPC split. So they were very particular about which contest they covered. Bob Kennedy was the only magazine that covered all the competitions. They covered the IFBB, the NPC, the AAU, NABA organization. And then when Serge Noubre created his WABA organization, or when Dan Lorry had his WBBG, or if there was any other organizations out there, Bob Kennedy would cover those. And he would also cover the athletes that came from those organizations. So for years, Bertel Fox, who was from England, was competing in the NABA competitions, and he was not coming over to the IFBB at first. And then he was competing in the WABA organization, Serge Noubre's new organization. The Weider magazines would never cover Bertel Fox. But of course, the rest of the bodybuilding world was very aware of Bertel because we saw pictures of him at the NABA Universe, and we saw his pictures in Muscle Mag. So Muscle Mag was really the first one to cover someone like Bertel Fox. And they also were covering Sergio Oliva before Sergio went back to the IFBB in 1984. Before that happened, Sergio was also competing in the WABA organization in 1980 and 81. So Bob Kennedy's magazine was a really lot of fun to read. He had some great articles in there. So I just recently put up an old interview I did with Jerry Branum, where we did 1981 in review part two, and we talked about the 1981 Mr. Olympia, but we also talked about the WABA Pro World Cup, which was held in Essen, Germany in 1981. And Sergio Oliva won that contest. And this was an organization created by Serge Noubre, WABA. And I was going back and I was looking at some of my magazines, and I was looking at some of the old muscle builder magazines I had. And I was like, wow, I didn't realize I had all these old ones. I've got some magazines from Muscle Builder. I've got the second one. I don't know if I have the first one, but I've got the second issue, which is volume one, issue number two. And so there was a great article in here by Rick Wayne, which I never read before. And it's called Weider is a Trip. And it's all about Rick Wayne going to the Weider offices for the first time when he started writing for him and his recollections. So I wanted to read that article. And then there was another one. This was from, let's see what year it was, 1976. So this was a great issue. This was from volume two, issue two. And it was from August 1976. So they had the premiere, the movie premiere of Stay Hungry, not Pumping Iron, but Stay Hungry, which came out in 1976. And it was held, I believe, in New York. And so Arnold is there, and they got a great picture of Arnold with Shelley Winters. And it's all about the premiere of the movie Stay Hungry, which I never read before. So I'm going to read that one as well. They also have another article in here about when Lou Ferrigno went into the Superstars competition, and he really downsized, and he did very well. And the Superstars competition, if you don't remember, it was a contest that was on TV, and it featured athletes from all different sports, but they were competing in sports that weren't their intended sport. So you would have runners competing in like weightlifting or rowing events or things like that. So Lou, as a bodybuilder, went into this competition. He did very well. He represented himself very, very well. After that, I've got another old Ironman. This was from Volume 3, Issue 1. So that would be August of 1977. And they have an article in here about Frank Zane called The Year of Zane. And, of course, this was the year that Frank Zane won the Mr. Olympia. But this article came out before the Mr. Olympia. It came out in August. The contest was in October. And it's written by Frank Zane. So it's really cool. It's his mindset going into the Mr. Olympia that year. And he called it The Year of Zane. So that was another really great article. So they got some really, really good articles in these old magazines. So I want to read these three for sure. And then I found some other ones from 1981. So, of course, this was the year that I was just talking about where they had the WABA Pro World. So Cal Scalak was in the WABA organization because he quit the IFBB or was suspended from the IFBB after 1978, after he took fifth place in the Mr. Olympia that year. So Cal still kept competing, and he was in 1980, he was in the WABA World Cup, which was held in Long Beach, California, and he got beat by Sergio. And then he also competed in 1981 when it was in Essen, Germany. So they got a really good article about Cal on how he trained his legs, chest, and back. And then there's another one from 1981. This was September issue, where Boyer Coe won the Atlantic City Cup. And this is written by Chris Lund. And this was a very interesting contest because it was open to amateur bodybuilders and professionals. And Bronston Austin, who was an amateur bodybuilder, he actually won the light heavyweight class the year before at the Mr. America. He competed in his first professional contest without actually being a professional, and he did very, very well. So that's going to be an interesting article. And then finally, I do have the contest report from the WABA World Cup that I was talking about, where Sergio Oliva beat Bertel Fox, and it was a really, really great contest. So I'm going to read that as well, and that was written by Robert Kennedy. So we got a lot of articles to read here, so you guys should really get your money's worth on this episode. We got a lot of great stuff to read. So yeah, if you want to check out that 1981 In Review Part 2, that is now on my YouTube channel, so check that out. Me and Jerry go over the WABA World Pro Cup, which was in Essen, Germany, and then we go over the Mr. Olympia from that year, 1981, and we do a pretty much a deep dive into the 1981 Olympia. So it's really pretty interesting. It's an old interview. I think I did it. It was released on the podcast in January of 2022. So it's, wow, almost 2 years old already. So I'm going back now and I'm trying to put up some of these old videos, interviews that I had. They were on the podcast right away, but they haven't been up on YouTube. So it takes a lot of editing to get these things done and trying to get them up one at a time. So I'm trying to get one or two up each week. I've also got one with Steve Brisbois, where we did part one of his interview. I've got that one up already on YouTube a while back, but now we're going to put up part two. That should be coming up this week. I just had to wait. I got a video from the 1991 Arnold Classic, where Steve placed sixth. And so I wanted to put his posing routine up from that. So I had to get that video transferred over to an MP4 so I could use it in the video. I got some bad news a couple of weeks ago. Joel Grassi died. Joel was the great lightweight bodybuilder who competed. He won his class at the 1987 NPC Nationals. This was the NPC Nationals that Sean Ray won. And also Phil Hill was in it too. He won the heavyweight class. So Joel Grassi was the lightweight winner. He was from Massachusetts. I think him and his brother owned a gym out there. And they were big staples in the bodybuilding community, and he was an excellent bodybuilder. I remember reading the contest report from 1987, and he was really, really a complete physique, what a great bodybuilder. So rest in peace, Joe Grassi. I don't know what he passed away from, but he did pass away a couple of weeks ago. So all the best to his friends and family. He was a great bodybuilder, and he, like you said, he made a big impact in that area on the East Coast. So I know he helped a lot of people with his gyms and everything. All right. I did also get a couple emails, so I want to read those and recognize these guys who wrote to me. So I got an interesting one. Yolanda saw my video on YouTube about bodybuilding history from the 1965 NABBA Mr. Universe. And Reg Park, this was Reg Park's last NABBA Mr. Universe win. I believe it was his third NABBA Universe win, and he won the professional division. But the amateur winner was Elmo Santiago from New York, and I got an email here from Yolanda Littlefawn, and it says, Elmo Santiago is my uncle and godfather. He owned two gyms in New York City, one in the Bronx and one in Washington Heights, Manhattan. Says he passed away on March 25th of this year. I did not know that. So rest in peace to Tio Elmo. We love and miss you. So I wanted to recognize that email. So I did not know Elmo passed away, but this goes all the way back to 1965 when he won the NABBA Universe. So that was a great win for him, probably the highlight of his life as far as competitive bodybuilding goes. So yeah, he's been around a long, long time. I did not know he passed away. I also got this one from Gary Wilhide, and he said, hey, John, I just thought I'd pass along that Arnold Schwarzenegger is on the Rich Roll podcast this week. Rich is a great interviewer. I have not listened to the episode yet, but I thought it might be interesting to you and your other listeners. Keep up the good work. I always look forward to your podcast. Yeah, I see Arnold is on the interview tour right now. He's promoting his new book, which I think comes out this month in October. So I think he was on Howard Stern as well. This one from Kevin Sosa, and Kevin says, hey, John, I just wanted to thank you for your podcast. I've listened to a lot of them now. Yours are very entertaining and informative. Thank you for what you do. All right. Thank you, Kevin. And that was it. That was all I got. So let me get started on these articles because I got a lot to read here, and I know you guys are going to enjoy these. If anyone else has any comments or any emails you want to share, just send them to naturalolympia@gmail.com, and I will read them on the air. All right, so let's get to this first article. And this one, like I said, this is the second issue of Muscle Mag International. It came out in April 1975, which I'm surprised it's that late because I thought Bob started these in 74. But it does say on the cover, Volume 1, Issue Number 2. So this is the second issue. So it says, Joe Weider is a trip, and it's written by Rick Wayne. Says the time is 8:45 a.m. on a balmy Monday in late August when I arrived by hired Cadillac at 21100 Irwin Street, Woodland Hills, eager to begin work. The job is not altogether new to me. 3 years ago, before the company outgrew the modest red brick structure from which we operated in Union City, New Jersey, and exchanged East Coast pollution for more tolerable Southern California smog, I was editor-in-chief of Muscle Builder Magazine. In those dark ages days, only close members of the family were invited to visit. But things are different now. The by appointment only atmosphere has given way to effusive slap on the back house party bonhomie. Anyone may drop in at any time. Everyone is welcome. The new Weider building stands two stories tall, an arrogant plum in the middle of what used to be the Warner Brothers Ranch, possibly the most photographed spread in all of America. Scene of 1001 Hollywood Westerns. Those were the days, my friend, we thought would never end, when Gary Cooper rode Tail at High Noon and Clint Eastwood was just a B feature player yet to hit the spaghetti trail to a fistful of dollars. The old ranch died on the cross of progress, and now a concrete jungle of office blocks stands in its place. A graying man in his early 50s is there to welcome me as I come through the glass-paneled front entrance. He smiles. His name is Lou. The boss promised to be in at 10 o'clock this morning, but he just phoned to say he'll be late. Some hassle to settle with his attorneys in Beverly Hills. He'll be over as soon as possible. Will I make myself at home until he arrives? That much hasn't changed. Same old Joe. I follow Lou into the showroom on the ground floor. Green barbell sets on chrome stands, three wall pulley machines, exercise benches, some covered with brown vinyl plastic, exercise charts, and back issues of Muscle Builder magazine. All items displayed carry the Weider brand. Three life-size paintings supply the right atmosphere here. Two that I have seen before in New York are of Larry Scott and Arnold Schwarzenegger, both Mr. Olympia winners. I posed for the third while I still work with the company in New Jersey, but before the finished work was delivered, I quit for home in the West Indies. And now I was seeing myself in oil for the first time. Beautiful. I smile wistfully. The boss had warned me in a long-distance telephone conversation only two nights before that I should forget any ideas about removing the painting from the showroom wall. He meant it, too. We leave the showroom, and Lou heads me into his office. The room was previously occupied by Lud Susterich, who ran Weider operations in Europe until the company went bust, and the boss brought him back to a new job in California. But as we say in the West Indies, two male rats cannot coexist peacefully in the same hole. Lud was moved out to make room for Lou, who until his promotion worked from an upstairs office. It is the Beautyman office, fully equipped with IBM Selectric intercom set, leather upholstered settees, and other executive paraphernalia. At both ends of a huge desk that stands in the center of Lou's office are two black and white television sets on whose 19-inch screens you will never see the Today Show or even Soul Train. For theirs is a Big Brother function strictly out of Orwell's 1984. A modest sort, Lou informs me somewhat sheepishly that the TV receivers are not his, but the previous occupant's brainchild. It seems that at one time the company lost thousands of dollars each week via the back door, but not anymore, not since Lud installed his sets. For now, every move in the mailroom upstairs and the warehouse in the back of the main building is monitored in Lou's office. The ground floor also supports a coffee room. I never did discover who dumped the empty cans in the trash bin each morning and afternoon, but someone at Weider obviously prefers the company's Protein 101 to Nescafe. Who needs a coffee break? It's the protein hour. Two very spacious Johns. Yes, I checked. A photo studio where most of the Weider advertisements are produced, and a spherical reception desk complete with PBX and gorgeous blonde operator. It is nearly 9:30 a.m. by the time Lou is through introducing me to the folks upstairs. The mailroom is manned by seven or eight beautiful young women, most of whom are students at UCLA and operate at Weider strictly on a part-time basis. These ladies handle more money orders in 1 week than many people care to believe. I gather one advertisement in Cosmopolitan can bring in as much as $35,000. But then the Weider building alone is tangible proof that Weider has taken the muscle business from a backwoods tidbits enterprise to its present big business status. Then there are the pretty secretaries who gush and blush at the mere mention of Frank Zane's name. Is there such a thing as a muscle groupie? And cringe when you say Sergio. The boss's office is a veritable palace crammed with enough antiques from liquor cabinet to telephone set, everything in early Europe and Indian America, to fill a small museum. The boss is not in bib, but many business associates who visit regularly do. Also on the top floor are the art rooms, library, George Hackenschmidt, John Grimmick, Bob Hoffman, Charles Atlas, all the old-time strongmen are in there, and writers' offices. Lou leads and I follow to an open door marked Muscle Builder Editor. Seated at the desk in the tiny office is a denim-clad figure, his disheveled blonde hair half buried in folded arms that are resting on his switched-off IBM typewriter. Lou taps a denim jacket. "Look who's here, Gene," he announces. Gene jumps up to his feet, startled. "Oh, yeah, Joe, Lou, hey, it's Rick Wayne. We've been expecting you all week, right, Lou? Nice to meet you, buddy. When did you come in? You going to stay?" Gene has apparently had a hard day's night from which he has not totally recovered. His bulging eyes are washed out blue on yellow and bloodshot. The overall effect is positively satanic, scary, like a character from Exorcist. And for a moment, I am disequilibrated. I'm not sure, I mutter. It all depends. "Man, it's going to be great working here with you. Joe, well, I guess, I mean, you know Joe, right? Hey, did I ever tell you I'm a soul brother? So help me, I am." With both hands, he tries to smooth the matted hair into place. It's a wasted effort. It falls right back on either side of his nose, and suddenly it strikes me that his hair and face are of similar shades. Almost as if he'd read my thoughts, he says, "Gee, I need a tan. I'm so fucking pale. But really, man, I'm a soul brother. My folks, you know, they come from Ethiopia. Like, shit, I'm not going to lie about it. Not like my sister. I don't go for all that crap. She's so hung up on passing for white. Not me. Screw them, I say. You are what you are, and it makes no sense at all. I mean, what do you want to say you're a crappy honky for anyway? Boy, wait till the Oak gets here. He and the Sardinian sidekick are going to be freaking out over my little black box this morning. Like I'm going to interview those two guys for some hot stuff articles." I tell him it's been years since I laid eyes on Arnold Schwarzenegger, and the last time I talked with Franco Colombo, we were competing for the Mr. Universe title in New York. "Yeah," he says, "I remember that one. Well, at least some slob, I can't remember who, told me about it. That's when they gave the title to another bodybuilder, even though you won nearly all the body part awards. Man, how about that mother? You know, that guy from Paris, what's his name? Nubre? We got your article on him 2 weeks ago. We're running in a muscle builder. Man, you write like, shit, man, I'm not going to dig having you here. That Joe, he owes me a darn check. Gene dropped into his chair. Whatever was bugging his head when Lou and I came in was at it again. Even before we left his office, he was fast asleep, his head resting on a black attaché case with Doc Savage painted in gold all over it. Lou shrugged his shoulders. He said he had some things to attend to in his office. I should take it easy till the boss arrived. I went into the library and picked out some issues of Muscle Builder. After nearly 4 years away from the muscle scene, I had some catching up to do. My association with Weider dates back to 1962, shortly after Lud Susterich arrived in England from California to head Weider Enterprises in Europe. In the beginning, Lud operated out of a little office in Croydon, half an hour by train from London Bridge. At the time, I was under contract to Pi Records, and what with having to earn my living as a singer doing gigs all over Europe, there was little time left for practicing the bodybuilding, which I first started at the age of 15 in St. Lucia. Contrary to the popular magazine line, I was never skinny. Indeed, by the time I moved to England to see the army and see the world, what a trusting fool I was then, I had developed 18.5-inch arms and a 48-inch chest, which, even though these were supported by puny 22-inch thighs, certainly did not add up to the physique of a polio victim. Then again, on second thought, well, never mind. Candidly, I had the kind of physique at 19 years of age that would not be disgraced even at this age of food supplements and anabolic steroids, both of which were unheard of in the West Indies of my youth. In 1962, however, my physique was more in keeping with the Mick Jagger mold. Nothing to write home about, but enough to stir a woman's blood, and in some cases, too, to rise, if not to mutiny. I did quite a lot of modeling at that time, and my pictures appeared in all kinds of magazines, from fashion journals to men's quarterlies. And let me say, the money was far from bad, even in those long-gone days. It was after one such modeling session for a quarterly with a fussy little chap who passed himself off as Lon Hannigan for years in London until the authorities discovered his penchant for 12-year-olds and shipped him back to New York, that I took the first step that was to lead eventually to Weider and professional bodybuilding. Lon had asked me to accompany a young German, his guest at the time, to a gym, any gym, so that he might take his daily workout. I was very impressed by the youth's massiveness, which even his thick sweater failed to disguise. As far as I was concerned, here was a champion in the flesh. He was the biggest I'd seen at the time, and I was being given the opportunity to watch him train. As we drove from Piccadilly Circus by taxi, I found myself becoming more and more interested in the idea of taking up bodybuilding all over again. Such was the effect of the young German's presence. I asked him all sorts of mundane questions, the same questions that would, in a few years later, bore me to tears, which he answered in halting English, but which nevertheless fired my blood. By the time our cab arrived outside Rube Martin's Tottenham Gymnasium in North London, I had made up my mind that I too would win a streak of physique awards like my German acquaintance had done. Rube Martin is to London what Sigmund Klein is to New York health addicts and Jowett was to Canada. More, perhaps, for not only was Rube a Mr. Universe competitor, he stood against Reg Park once and placed fifth, he appeared in numerous shows both on television and the West End stage as a top-flight comedian, and he was a strong man to be reckoned with. Rube's gym was also quite famous. It has since given way to Progress, pulled down in the interest of a supermarket, throughout Europe. At one time, no less than Reg Park and Len Sell, a two-time winner of the Mr. Universe title, trained there regularly. Apparently, the success of these men had more to do with Rube's instruction than the actual gym, for the building, even in those days, was ripe and ready for demolition. You got to the gym floor via 15 rickety wooden steps, and then you joined the other masochists who apparently enjoyed training with their hearts beating wildly in their mouths. How that floor never caved in, I'll never know. There was no heating system at Rube's, so that the customers kept warm literally by generating their own steam. Rube used to answer requests for heat with the standard, "I thought you geezers came here to toughen up." The line worked, at least most of the time. 3 months after I joined the Kooks at Rube's, I started getting ideas about physique competition. Not that I thought anyone in the gym came even close to my standard, modesty being my biggest asset. One Saturday morning, I joined some of the lads for a trip to Weider's in Croydon in search of food supplements. I recognized Lud Susterich from his pictures in my old copies of Strength and Health. There was one article on muscle power published by Weider way back in the late 40s, in which someone kicked up some fuss over Dick Dubois' Mr. America win. The way the writer saw it, Lud should have taken the big award. But 1962, Lud Susterich looked nothing like Mr. America might. But he was some salesman. He might easily have ghosted How to Win Friends and Influence People for Dale Carnegie. He was so influenced me that I ended up purchasing $200 worth of pills, drinks, and powders when I had come in meaning to spend just $20. If only Lud had kept to selling instead of pretending he was some major American business executive. My visits to Croydon would become more and more frequent, and each time I visited, Lud would talk me into posing for him. An easy task, really. Soon he was writing courses for me that I discarded the minute I left his office. The darn things were apparently designed to break my back or worse. And then I entered the Mr. Britain 1963 contest. I really was not surprised when I was voted the big winner. Any other result would have been ridiculous. I mean, I know my strength. Phew. Soon I was receiving free food supplements from Lud and Muscle Builder. The British edition was featuring me like I was the greatest thing to happen in Britain since Churchill. Well, come to think of it. I remember staying at Earl Menard's while fulfilling a week-long singing engagement in Manchester. At that time, Earl was already a physique star, having competed in a number of Mr. Universe contests. His popularity was further enhanced by regular appearances in televised wrestling bouts. But my friend would agree to appear in muscle shows miles and miles from his home for as little as $60, including traveling and other expenses. "Wait till I'm ready," I used to tell him. "The Scrooge promoters will be happy to fork out a whole lot more for me." And they did, of course, even before I became known internationally. Admittedly, I gave more value for money than most physique stars of the time. I sang, posed, performed feats of strength, including a 280-pound press behind the neck at less than 200 pounds body weight. I blew up a hot water bottle a la Chuck Sipes, and I even arm-wrestled members of the audience. I also conducted a question-and-answer session that was probably the most popular part of my act. I remember one show in the Midlands, Frank Richard was a promoter. A young man informed me that he had a question but would wait later until he could ask it in the privacy of my dressing room. Naturally, I begged him to put the question to me while I was still on the stage, but he insisted he wanted to wait. He came into the dressing room a little later to ask, "Rick, you appear to have practically everything a young man might want. Popularity, a successful bodybuilding career, a contract with a recording company, the works. Are there times when you find yourself wishing you were white?" Stupid me. There I was thinking the guy wanted to know my shortcut to eye-popping vascularity. Well, I answered his question this way. "Yes," I said, "there have been times when I wish I had a white skin, like the time I did not get to do a commercial on British television because the producer thought Britain was not quite ready to have a black kissing a blonde in their living rooms. But I always had one condition, that once I'd use my white skin for my purpose, I would be able to peel it off and resume my normal color." My friend simply loved my answer. By the end of 1964, a full-length feature with pictures of me appeared at the American edition of Muscle Builder. Now I was made, as they say in England. Soon I was receiving letters from all over the U.S. and Europe. I was ready for the big plunge. I trained even harder than before, and I consumed enough supplements to boost my body weight from 170 pounds at the end of 1964 to a hard 200 pounds in August 1965. And then came the Weider offer that would have such revolutionary effects on my life. Joe Weider would pay all my expenses to New York and back if I competed in the IFBB Mr. Universe contest that September. Moreover, I stood to earn $1,000, big money then, for a series of articles, six, I think, and an endorsement. In fairness to Weider, I must admit his food supplements are the very best I've ever used. It's also true to say that I never got around to using the different brand, and therefore I cannot comment one way or another about his competitors' products. The Weider deal added more fire to my already simmering ambition. Now I was training by the book, incorporating every Weider publicized principle into my twice-daily workouts. Before I agreed to do a singing engagement out of London, I would demand the promoter's insurance that there was a gym close to my hotel. No gym, no deal. 2 days before my departure to New York, my first visit, I received a telegram at Lud's office in Purley. He had moved from Croydon by this time. A United Nations diplomat was offering me his hospitality. It would give him immense pleasure if I agreed to stay at his penthouse for the duration of my visit. He had long admired my physique, and he wanted to discuss a number of things with me, including a job at Ebony Magazine. He would gladly pick me up at Kennedy Airport on the day of my arrival. That same day, I faced the biggest choice that I've ever had to make. The producers of Boy Meets Girl, a TV pop music show on the lines of Soul Train, with great influence on the record-buying public, were offering me a five-minute spot to plug a record that I had out at the time, Say You're Gonna Be My Own, on the CBS label. I had to choose between flying to New York for the Mr. Universe contest and making that very important to my singing career television appearance. Finally, I decided in favor of New York. I felt my physical condition placed me in a very good position to win the big title. Well, that's self-confidence. Moreover, I couldn't, after all the strenuous work I put in preparing for the contest, simply let it all go to waste just for a television show that, as important as it undoubtedly was really no guarantee that my record would skyrocket up to the charts. As luck would have it, Earl Menard was also scheduled to fly to New York on my flight. He was also sponsored by the Weider office in Britain. Only days earlier, Menard had beaten Serge Nubre for the Mr. Universe NABBA title. Now he was aiming for the Big Apple, the Mr. Olympia title. This was the second year of the IFBB-initiated contest. Larry Scott won the first year. Naturally, I told Earl about the Mr. Diplomat's invitation, even though he was not included. I gathered special arrangements had already been made for him in New York anyway. Unfortunately, as is my habit, I missed my scheduled flight, but Earl didn't. Not surprisingly, when I arrived in New York some 6 hours late, there was no one to meet me. However, I took a cab to my host address. A uniformed doorman rode with me to the top floor, and then he let me into my host penthouse. Mr. Diplomat was not at home. However, he had given instructions that I should be let in if I arrived in his absence. Talk about plush. From the oil paintings on the walls to the expensive furniture, everything stank of functional luxury. I sank to my ankles in the thick carpet. I discovered there were two bedrooms, one with a very seductive-looking double bed, which obviously was the master bedroom. The other held a single bed on which lay a chest expander and some items of clothing that I thought I recognized immediately, but I couldn't be sure. I was watching I Love Lucy on the 23-inch color TV when the doorbell tinkled. My suspicions were confirmed when I answered. Practically taking up the whole doorway was my friend Earl Menard, the owner of the clothes on the single bed. And standing behind him was a red-nosed gentleman who later turned out to be Mr. Diplomat, my host. I tried to explain my non-arrival at the airport, but Mr. Diplomat brushed my excuse aside. Never mind about that. I was in New York after all, and that was all that mattered. Then I learned how Earl got to be the occupant of a small bedroom instead of me. He had been the only muscle man to arrive on my scheduled flight, and naturally, Mr. Diplomat had approached him to inquire of my whereabouts. Earl had told him the obvious, that I had not taken the flight as planned. Only he had chosen to add the distinct possibility that I had changed my mind about competing in New York. At that, what could Mr. Diplomat do but offer my bed to Earl? Naturally, my friend accepted. Simple as that. I might not have minded at all had circumstances been a little different, like if Mr. Diplomat had not been so obviously a strange one, and if his halitosis had not been so devastating. But now I faced the prospect of sharing his bed. Well, I tried to postpone bedtime for as long as I could, but when I found myself nodding and falling all over my chair, what with the time difference between New York and London, I gave in. To cut what might have been a sordid short story, sorry to disappoint you, Chappie, I got no trouble whatsoever from my host, except for his halitosis. He must have realized I had not come out to play, and being a diplomat, decided to let sleeping dogs lie. At breakfast the following morning, Menard would have much fun asking whether I had paid the supreme price. No way. Later, Earl and I traveled by taxi, courtesy of Mr. Diplomat, to the Brooklyn Academy of Music for the prejudging of the contest. I met for the first time such bodybuilding luminaries as Freddie Ortiz, Rock Stonewall, Frank Zane, Bill McCardle, Dave Draper, Larry Scott, who would be my hero for years afterwards. I've dubbed him the eighth wonder of the world, and Harold Poole. I was amazed to hear these fellows openly talking about clothes, hairdressers, photographers, and Dr. Strangelove. In England, the chaps are much more discreet. I was in the warm-up room preparing for my appearance before the judges, Leroy Colbert, Kimon Voyages, Dr. Jules Levine, and Tom Miniacello, bodybuilding's Mr. Nice Guy among them, when Earl walked in with the news that he would be competing for the Mr. Universe title. I laughed, thinking he was being merely funny, but I soon realized he was deadly serious. Until that moment, I felt pretty good about my chances of winning the award. But now, my blue mood lasted only a short while, however, for it was not as if Earl would be taking the title back to Greece or North Carolina. He was a fellow West Indian living in Britain, and really, I didn't mind sharing the spoils with him. We'd both be taking the stuff to England. It must be understood that at the time, I never considered myself in the same class as Menard. I mean, he'd been at the game much longer than I. Well, we finally did our thing for the judges, and although we both received fantastic applause from the small audience, I remained convinced Earl would emerge Mr. Universe 1965, while I satisfied myself with my height class award. Much later, before a packed house, I watched from the wings as my Barbadian friend went through his posing routine. "Go to it, Earl," I screamed. "Sock it to him." I mean, I was taking no chances. I didn't want some American taking the title, you understand? When my turn came to pose, the applause was deafening, but I knew it would be Earl's night. Finally, the title did go to Menard, and I took a few body part awards, the best Prosser trophy, and my height division. I was ecstatic. Justice had been done. I would later learn that up until that last bit of posing, I had been voted Mr. Universe. In fact, my cheering for Earl had been instrumental in changing the judges' earlier decisions. A quarter point saved the day for my friend. The big show ended shortly after 10:30 p.m., and I couldn't have been more tired. It's surprising how much a physique contest takes out of you. The pumping up, the posing, the butterflies in your gut, the waiting for the final results to be announced. But I accepted Joe Weider's invitation to supper. Also invited were Earl Menard, Larry Scott, Dave Draper, and Chuck Sipes. Oh, I almost forgot. Larry took the Mr. Olympia title. And to this day, I wonder why Earl chickened out of competing. This supper after show idea has become over the years a ritual that it is as much looked forward to by the IFBB champs as by Joe Weider. Joe always pays, by the way. The annual supper proves the ideal opportunity for discussing the latest training methods, for getting things off the chest, and fixing business deals. From the start, I found Joe Weider is a very interesting personality. Obviously very successful at his chosen game, the man is nevertheless completely without airs. Well-read, self-educated, in fact, Joe makes sense just talking about psychology, anatomy, nutrition, politics, racism, arts, movies, and records. I suspect his very favorite artist is Johnny Cash. We washed down steaks that were 2 inches thick with seemingly gallons of ice cream or milkshakes. The system seems to demand those calories after the rigors of contest preparation. Joe Weider drove Menard and me to our friend's penthouse. En route, we closed a number of deals, including an agreement that I would endorse his products for 1 year and write some articles for his magazine. Also an added bonus, he gave us both tickets to the West Indies. Earl would visit his folks in Barbados, and I would go to St. Lucia. So much for Cheapskate Joe. Personally, I know Weider is a regular guy who keeps his word once he's given it, even though I've heard stories to the contrary from other guys. It must be told that Weider continues to give the top bodybuilders the opportunity to cash in on their fame. From Reg Park to Arnold Schwarzenegger, most of the top muscle stars have done well, thanks to Joe. And here I must include the legendary Steve Reeves. See your old copies of Your Physique and Muscle Power. Joe Weider is also a most forgiving man. Lord knows the number of bodybuilders who've broken contracts with him. Joe could have sued dozens of times, but he doesn't. Instead, he puts it all down to insecurity and forgives. I have found Joe a man who believes in the dignity of man. I recall that while I worked with Weider in New Jersey, a certain name bodybuilder collected nearly $200 a week from Joe simply for writing 2 articles a month. And before you jump to conclusions, let me make it perfectly clear that all this fellow wrote was 10 or so lines on a piece of notepaper. Useless stuff. Naturally, a staff writer later did the required piece. Why didn't Joe simply assign the writer to do the job? I believe Joe felt it would hurt the muscle man's pride to pay him merely for the use of his name, so he let the bodybuilder feel he was earning his $200. Don't ask me to explain. The fact is, similar outfits pay named bodybuilders less than $200 for the privilege of using their names indefinitely, and we're talking of one payday. Arnold's entry into the movie business, Draper's too, had much to do with the Joe Weider's influence, and I believe Arnold would be the first to give thanks to Joe for his good fortune at the time. In time, I would get to know Weider as well as any man might. On my return to England after my holiday in St. Lucia, I became a regular contributor to the Weider magazines. The ensuing policy helped my singing career immensely, but finally I would choose writing as the means to survival. Joe made frequent visits to the UK during the time Ludd ran Weider Europe, and naturally we discussed subjects from bodybuilding to jazz. I'd make a number of trips to the US for shows, all sponsored by Weider. And then in 1969, I moved to New York to take up the job of editor on the Muscle Builder staff. Oh, I enjoyed working with Joe. He gave me free rein, and I believe I wrote some pretty provocative stuff at my time in New Jersey. But then I suddenly got this urge to return home for a while. For a while turned out to last nearly 3 years, depending on which time I kept in contact with Joe, both by telephone and the mail. And eventually I started missing working on Muscle Builder. I discussed the matter with Joe over the phone. Joe always pays. And before I knew it, he sent tickets out to both my wife and me. Only I had read someplace that moving to California was more of a physical thing. It has to do with the psyche. I came out alone, so I would make up my mind that I would really wanted to move back with Weider. Arnold and Franco arrived at 10:45 a.m. Gene was still a little bleary-eyed, but the sight of Arnold seemed to perk him up. He offered the big Austrian a chair, which he fished out of an ancient Panasonic from the debris of his desk. Finally, he was ready to interview Mr. Schwarzenegger for Muscle Builder. He switched on the recorder. The last time, Gene recalled on tape, we discussed Arnold's all-out torture bombing routine that Arnold uses on his double-split training days on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. We discussed how he incorporates his chest and back workouts to produce a massive upper body pump and how he saves time in his workouts. He gets an all-out killer instinct type workout, driving himself unmercifully for 1 hour, lasting out 45 sets for his chest and back with tremendously heavy poundages. Gene is a master of Weiderness, a technique created by Joe Weider, especially for Weider as a muscle builder. The success of Weider is reflected in the fact that throughout the world, from the U.S. to Hong Kong, yes, even in non-English-speaking territories, bodybuilders talk of blitzing, supersets, pumping, and gorging. Gene will write his recorded introduction exactly as he had during his interview with Arnold. He goes on, "Now in this article, the last article featuring his chest, Arnold spoke of specialization, how you can add new dimensions to your chest workout. Now we'll discuss the techniques of his back training, how he builds muscular mass and striations, how he developed the greatest upper body of all time. Arnold, the first exercise, your wide grip chins. We already knew the weights and the reps, but what part of the back do you feel the chins work best?" Gene is apparently more pooped out than he knows. You can tell by the gaps in his recorded preamble. But Arnold is on the ball. He leans close to the recorder mic. "Well, first of all, Gene, I wish to say that just because a guy does their chins, that does not mean the guy is gay. Ho, 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 ho." Laughs all around. Even Franco Colombo, who came in while Gene was talking, is cracking up, although he's heard the gag before on Gold's Santa Monica Gym. Arnold goes on. "Gaddy means if someone does his wide grip chins during a blowjob. Ho, 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 ho." More belly laughs. "Funny man. Look out, Bob Hope. The Germans are coming." Gene grabs the mic to contribute his share. "This tape is for sale at Music City. For your $2.95 copy to..." The only laugh comes from Gene. Poor Gene. Now Arnold is serious again. "I perform chins in combination with my chest work. Number one, the chest, the pecs, the chest, it pulls the pecs apart after doing a set. And number two, it widens the back. In my opinion, chins are strictly for width. That's why guys like Lou Degney from way back who used to do, you know, chins like 200 reps every day, they had huge wide lats, but not thick, you know, just wide. Dave Draper will do 10 sets of pulldowns on the machine. He has wide lats, but not thick lats. You know, I think this is the exercise which you concentrate on for a huge V-type body. That's the reason why I'm doing chins." Gene figures erroneously that Arnold is through. He moves in with another question, but only manages to get out okay before Arnold is rapping again. "There are many kinds of different chins," says Arnold, "the front chin and the chins in the back. To me, there isn't much different of how you do the chins if you do them in front or back. It's just a matter of preference, actually. Mostly, I do it to the back of my neck. I would say, I think the best way to pull your body up without kicking movements or anything like that. Just pull up with the arms and then with the shoulder blades and the lats until the bar touches the back. of the neck. Let your body down slowly again all the way. A big mistake many people do, they stay cramped up and then they do not let the body stretch. It's very important to go all the way down and relax totally your shoulder blades before you start up again. And when you cannot do another rep, keep going, you know, quarter movements until you can't do even that anymore. Then I just go off. So really, I use all the energy in my lats and my hands to do the chins and to train my back. But by this time, my lats are so pumped, I just go over to a, you know, a fixed bar and I just grab it and stretch my lats more. Now Gene gets in there. Do you do your reps, I mean? No, I just stretch a little. There's a particular way you do that. You just pull and stretch your lats. So I do 3 or 4 sets with no weight, and then I do 2 sets with maybe 30 or 40 pounds, nothing heavy, because you're not able to use big weights when you do chins correctly. The interview lasts just over an hour, at the end of which the massive Arnold is checking his watch and talking about time to eat again, but that's when Joe Weider comes in. Joe has changed little in 3 years. His hair is still thick and jet black, and these days he wears it quite long, as it is in fashion. He's sporting a blue shirt with flower patterns, blue slacks, and blue leather shoes. His mustache is thick but neatly trimmed, and by the look of him, he's been putting in time at Gold's. Joe trains whatever time permits, and when he does, he bombs with the enthusiasm of a Mr. America contestant. He steps into the crowd office. Anywhere that Arnold parks his massive frame has got to be crowded. Places his attaché case on Gene's overlooked desk and puts out his right hand in my direction. Glad to see you again, Rick, he says, pumping my hand. Looked around yet? I tell him it's good to be back. Not strictly true at the time. And yes, I have been shown around the place. It's just beautiful. He explains that he had to stay longer in Beverly Hills than he had planned. We'd talk things over at lunch. He would treat Arnold, Franco, and me to steaks. But first he had an idea about the Department of Muscle Builder called Ask Arnold. Arnold thinks it's a great title, and then Joe comes something about pumping under that. This department is not for beginners, only for champs. Gene moans about his lunch, and he says he's not feeling too good, and Joe admonishes him for not living the clean life. You'll kill yourself, Gene, he says, like a concerned uncle. Finally, Gene exits, and Joe explains he is not working full-time here. He just comes in when he feels like it. Joe goes ahead with the questions anyway. Do bodybuilders use steroids? Do the champs take drugs? Do you ever have a training break? Arnold answers everything, and Joe has to remind him to be brief. It's not a feature we're doing, just a question and answer page. And then we all go to Joe's Cadillac and head for the nearest restaurant. Over lunch, we talk about old times. Joe tells me I'm going to enjoy working in California. I was never meant to live in a small country, not with my revolutionary ideas. We talk about Black Power, Nixon, physique contests. And before we know it, it's well past 3 p.m. Arnold and Franco go their own way, and I return to the office with Joe. I last just 2 weeks. It was not that I'm no longer wish to work with Weider, but I'm deeply involved in my country's political scene. I'm required to run a newspaper back home. I tell Joe I'll return in a few weeks' time, and I fly off to St. Lucia. Elections are over. My side has won, and now my wife and I are ready to move on again. To Weider in California? To Canada? To London? Who knows? I think I would love to give Weider a try in earnest. I'll write my little friend a letter this evening. Maybe I'll call. The end. All right. Very long and interesting article by Rick Wayne, as only Rick can write it. He was the best. So that was interesting. So that was in 1975, right? And then Rick did come back in 76. He was working for Joe then, because that's when he got his injury and his neck, and he was not able to compete in the Olympia. And then Franco won the Olympia that year. All right. So this one comes from the August 1976 issue, like a year later. And this is about Arnold and the premiere of Stay Hungry. And it says, Stay Hungry, Arnold makes a hit, and it's written by Denny. Uh-oh, is this the beginning of another muscle cycle in motion pictures? As this is written, it's a little too early to tell by the premiere of Charles Gaines' novel about Southern life, and bodybuilding in particular, taking big screen form. Stay Hungry happened on April 25th, 1976, at the Trans Lux East Theater on the Upper New York East Side at 58th Street. Directed by Bob Rafelson with Harold Schneider producer, it hopefully is the vanguard of a sinew-type muscle cycle. But it got rather a mixed bag of comment in response to its initial opening. The film itself didn't make too many people happy, but our own big Arnold Schwarzenegger seemed to be received well and even heralded at certain times, even by the New York critics. Author's remark, New York critics are a scruffy lot that's hard to please. Wanted to say that for a long time. Here's how some of the reviews emerged. Experts of Vincent Canby from the New York Times on Monday, April 26, 1976, reads, Stay hungry. There are good performances by Jeff Bridges as an oddball of landed Birmingham gentry, by Sally Field as his less-than-blue-blood mistress, and by Arnold Schwarzenegger as a Mr. Universe contestant, a nice, honorable young man. Next came Kathleen Carroll of the Daily News, who gave the film 2.5 stars. Occasionally, the actors rise above the shambles of a script. Jeff Bridges is nicely loose, as always, but he's unable to give the main character any real dimension. In the plot, Bridges, who plays a young, rich playboy type, meets Arnold and falls for Sally Field, Arnie's girl in the beginning. Miss Carroll also has this to say about that. He also befriends a champion muscle man played with appealing dignity by a former Mr. Universe, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and winds up in a ferocious battle with a gym owner. A skirt-chasing lush who is truly a terrifying brute, as played by R.G. Armstrong. To Miss Carroll, we say, you're right. The film is no Gone with the Wind, and thanks for recognizing something we've known for years. Arnie's got it. Okay, we must admit the film is nothing for kids with its raunchy sex scenes and catering to varying side-tripping, but no, it's no porno film either. We have a lot of younger readers of different feelings and morality standards who potentially could be offended by its content. We are duly bound to them as a responsible publication to say to them, this motion picture is only for the most broad-minded in its comedy and emotional standpoint. We did speak to a number of people in the audience about this to check on their personal responses to these things, both in regard to film content and the view of bodybuilding the movie portrays. Everyone saw it in a totally different light. We first discussed Stay Hungry with Vinny Reno, who was at one point in his career was considered to be one of the best-built short men in the world and held the titles of Mr. Staten Island, Best Poser in Mr. New York, Mr. Eastern America, Mr. North America, and a cartload of other titles he declined to mention. I thought Arnold did a great job. The film did a pretty good job in describing the life of a bodybuilder. It goes into depth about the suffering, about the dieting, and all the things the bodybuilder has to give up in order to compete in contests. It reaches a pretty good climax. The climax evolves around the contest, the Mr. Universe contest, which Arnold has been training for all during the course of the film. He's quite impressive when the shirt comes off because that's the first shot you see of him all through the movie, and that's near the end. Otherwise, until the contest and climax, he acts with his clothes on. They say that if you really want to know what's happening with how a motion picture is being received, just ask the theater manager. So we did, and we spoke with Andrew Makowski, manager of the Translux East. How was the opening night of Stay Hungry, and what was the response of the audience? The audience reaction's good. The film is good. The folks coming to see it are in good spirits. I myself enjoyed it. Arnold in the film is a warm person. I was very moved, particularly by the contrast of him playing the fiddle and being a Mr. Universe. He's a strong and sympathetic character in the movie. The first show here today was predominantly a male audience. They were all very big men. I think if they had converged on the theater in a classic Roman phalanx, nothing could have stopped them from going in. I was more than just interested in seeing what this audience was going to be, because after all, I'm going to be with this film for as long as it's here. And I feel good about the audience, since now it's not only a male audience. As the days progress, the audience has become more mixed, male and female. The female response is good for the most part. Naturally, I've heard a few negative comments, but more positive than negative, plus more smiles than frowns. Mr. Makowski, aside from directing the activities of the Translux, is engaged in conducting his own news column for a leading theatrical publication in the United States called Cinema City. It appears in Marbel Film News and Comments. Next, we spoke with John Cruise, a bodybuilder just coming out of the orchestra entrance. I thought the movie was fabulous. It wasn't all about bodybuilding, but the little bit it depicted wasn't negative. They didn't say anything bad about bodybuilding, except for the gym owner in the picture who was a little nutty. You simply don't get the stereotypes of bodybuilders not being able to run. You see scenes where they run, perform handstands, they balance on top of buses. I mean, I like it. It was sad, and you felt sorry and moved by the essential drama. The motion picture contained a not too tasteful rape scene at the conclusion, supplemented by many vignettes of sexual action and foreplay throughout. We asked John his reaction to that. The film was building towards something and you didn't know what it was. Then when it happened finally, you knew all the pieces started coming together and you understand what's been going on. Except for that, you may get a little lost in the subplots. I feel it'll be a popular film. I didn't expect Arnold to do as good as he did. I was hoping they wouldn't dub his voice, and they didn't. He was good and relaxed in his part. We needed a lady's opinion on the mayhem of Stay Hungry, so we next spoke with a beautiful creature from the Bronx who had just garnered an autograph of the film's World's Newest Sparkle, Arnold S. What'd you think of the film with all the sex and male chauvinism in it? I liked the film. As far as bodybuilding goes, I don't know much about that. I dug the freedom in the movie, but I don't go into the woman's lib, though. I just came to see Arnold. He's just great. He's out of sight. I liked him. Well, okay. Okay. But some people were seriously offended by the film's content and depiction of bodybuilding in general. One such person who took great odds was the vice president of the International Federation of Bodybuilders, Thomas Minichiello. Tom, as all fans of the sport know, owns and operates New York's finest bodybuilding establishment, Mid-City Gym. He's a fiercely sensitive man when it comes to the image of our sport, and he finds anything that will cast dispersions or ominous shadows over it. The week of the premiere, Arnold trained at Mid-City and was photographed for Playboy with Sally Field, his co-star, around the gym. These are Tom's feelings on the significance of the final reel, which contained a sequence showing a staged Mr. Universe contest with the IFBB letters very much in evidence on screen. I thought the acting was good by everyone in the film. I felt especially Arnold came across very well. Sally and Jeff were great. The sets were adequate and interesting, but as soon as I saw the part where they showed the movie's Mr. Universe event, I didn't like it. No, wait, one other thing. I didn't care for how they made the Arnold character look while training. He exercised wearing a Batman costume. This is the way I try to look at it. The approach is as though somebody's looking at bodybuilding for the first time. They know nothing about bodybuilding and bodybuilders, and they go to see this movie. What would they think? I mean, they think it's a joke. They can't possibly take our sport as a serious sport. Impossible. How can they when they see a champion in the film training in his gym togs as a hooded Batman while another fellow off to the side beating the drum to pace him? He's banging the drums while Arnold's doing his squats. The most offensive part of all to me was when the bodybuilders run out into the streets during the physique contest. They're posing on corners, on top of trucks and buses. I thought this was ridiculous. I mean, I don't think Hollywood would do this to any other sport. They would treat baseball, football, swimming as serious sports, which they are. If you see this film and you know nothing about our sport, you simply experience a sad testament to all the things the art and science of bodybuilding is definitely not about. As far as the IFBB goes, I saw the letters IFBB in the scene and I didn't like it. It was ridiculous. In the movie, the actors and extras who played the part of the contest audience crowd were a seedy, scrounging looking sample of humanity, which in no way comes close in one degree to real-life bodybuilding audiences. I speak from 30 years' experience. With this picture, what we've seen on TV and magazines, I feel the media is 100% responsible for not lifting up the general image of bodybuilding. They do absolutely nothing for it. If talk show hosts like Johnny Carson interview a bodybuilder, it's always done as a joke. I don't think Charles Gaines was happy with the film, even though he co-scripted it with Rafelson. Canby of the Times mentioned this, saying Rafelson may have interfered with the true integrity of the original Stay Hungry novel too much. I hope when Pumping Iron, the film documentary of Gaines' second book about bodybuilding, is released, we'll find it a more uplifting viewpoint for our sport. It should be that way because I think Gaines and George Butler, who are both bodybuilders and they like training and they're going to go do it by themselves. I further think that the director, Bob Rafelson, has never been in a gym and he's never trained. He might have put in what he thought would be a commercially considered funny just to sell the picture. Generally speaking, most of my gym people liked the film and they took it in good spirits. We bodybuilders usually do, even though such things may be insulting to our nature. Someday things won't be that way. Arnold, who plays muscle man Joe Santo in the film, attended the premiere accompanied by Shelley Winters, one of Hollywood's most respected big names in film. He confided to a close source that Shelley, who he met on television's Mike Douglas show, has used her connections to open some doors for him in Hollywood. As the bit of information goes, Arnie is obtaining a voice coach to cultivate his Austrian vocal cords. Why he's doing this, we do not know. He has an excellent speaking voice. We wonder where this new change in his life might take him in the next 10 years. Might we be seeing a 195-pound Schwartz playing gangsters, cowboys, and symbols of societies put upon men who occupy the dramatic slots of TV and film? Very likely, Arnold might hearken this new type of success, leaving his muscle compatriots behind in the dust. Regardless, he'll always keep his healthy shape, for health is his true religion, and the body is his temple, whether it's at 230, 200, or 180 pounds. But let us say this. What a sad waste his casting in the improper roles would be, and what a terrible loss of the best-built man. We tender the following list of roles that we think Arnold could win giant laurels in playing. For this, we turn to the world of fiction and science fiction and fantasy, for the magnificent that is Arnold is not of our world, but far above our level of scope. Let us ponder his mass on film. Why not as the majestic Lord of the Jungle, Tarzan, or Robert E. Howard's barbarian character, Conan the Conqueror? We all know now what he looks like in a Batman costume, so why not Batman? Or in the part of a massive athletic comic hero like Submariner or Aquaman? Whatever, we hope Hollywood doesn't squander our new star champion. The rain fell heavily that night in Manhattan, but every seat of the Translux Theater was full for our show. A very interesting thing did happen. A young black-haired man sat pondering the film and then later congratulated Arnold on his performance. The significance of this is that at one point in Arnold's physique career, this gentleman hoped to dethrone him. What thoughts went through this man's mind as he watched Arnold on the screen? Who can say? The original Joe Santo character in Gaines' novel was a dark Mediterranean type, not an Austrian. But who was this man? Dennis Tinerino tells us that he was up for the role at one point before scripting reworked it for Arnold to fit the lead. Yet it was not Dennis who later enthusiastically congratulated Arnold in the lobby, but who, for a twist of fate, might have well been up on the screen. Maybe, just maybe, he will now ascend to the world bodybuilding throne if Arnold leaves for a film career. His name? Lou Ferrigno. Stay hungry. All right. Good article. And they did predict Arnold's future in films because they said he went to the science fiction realm, and that's exactly what he did. I think in the beginning, if you heard my interview with Jerry, where we talked about Arnold's documentary on Netflix, and we talked about that part of where Arnold talks about his movie career, I think Arnold was planning on becoming a serious actor like Jeff Bridges. But then I think after he had trouble getting a good role after Pumping Iron, I think he just waited until Conan came out, which was like 5 years later. And then that was what he really wanted to play. He just wanted to be more of a movie star and less of a serious actor, which was a great move, of course, for Arnold's part. He became the number one actor in the world, number one movie star in the world. That was a great move by Arnold. Like the guy said, he fit more into the science fiction realm because his body was so crazy looking compared to the average person that he was perfect in the science fiction world. All right. This next article comes from another early Muscle Mag. It is from 1977, August 1977. It's called The Year of Zane by Frank Zane. This is part one of a series of articles by Frank Zane. Frank is known to have one of the most symmetrical physiques of all time. Here, he lets you know his plans for entering the Mr. Olympia on October 1st in Columbus, how he is training, and exactly what he's doing for his back development. 1977 is the year of Zane. Yes, this will be my best year ever in bodybuilding. With this in mind, I'm approaching my training in a most intense and scientific manner. After the disappointment of losing Mr. Olympia in 1976 by 1 point, my enthusiasm and determination are stronger than ever, and I'm leaving nothing to chance in preparing for the big one this year. I really feel it's necessary for me to make a super effort and train harder than ever before. I think that by coming in with no weak points this year, an outstanding muscular condition, with a fantastic posing presentation, victory will be mine. For years, it seems the massive muscular physique has been in vogue in the bodybuilding world, starting with the massiveness of Scott, Oliva, Schwarzenegger, and finally Colombo. The bodybuilding public has been conditioned into thinking that big and muscular is best. Not that these men weren't great, for they certainly were. It's just that a bodybuilder from the symmetrical category hasn't gotten enough exposure in order to make a strong statement to win. That is, until now. Basically, there are two types of physiques. The muscular, as exemplified by the former Mr. Olympia winners, and the symmetrical. I put myself in the latter category. Reeves did much to popularize the symmetrical type, but since Reeves, there hasn't been anyone to keep the symmetrical physique type as popular with physique fans as it should be. This is what I regard as my responsibility, to give the symmetrical type the recognition it deserves, and this is what I will do this year. I have always been very analytical in my training. I analyze every exercise, set, rep I do, and pay attention to every single variable in my training. A variable is anything that has the capacity to change in one's training. There are many, many variables in training. Foods, amount of sleep, intake of food supplements, length of workout, amount of time between sets, poundages used, etc. My approach involves mastering all variables and therefore putting me in total control of what I will look like. The reason I'm so sure of myself and my training is because I have mastered the variable that most bodybuilders pay no attention to. That is the part the mind plays in bodybuilding. A bodybuilder's mind can be his own worst enemy if he lets his mind control him. The idea is to see the mind for what it is and then work with the mind to improve your training. I outline how to do this in my new course, The Mind in Bodybuilding. The secret is learning how to use concentration to improve your workouts. By doing regular exercises to improve concentration, a bodybuilder's workouts will improve. Workouts and their effectiveness are directly proportional to one's ability to concentrate. If you're training and your mind wanders between sets or while you're doing repetitions, you may not even get a pump. On the other hand, if you are thoroughly engrossed with what you are doing, your workout will be unbelievable. Basically, the condition with the mind is this. Your mind is what's on your mind. By developing the ability to concentrate on what you're doing to the point that what you're doing totally absorbs you, you leave no room for doubts, fears, distractions, and all that remains is a positive, productive attitude. In effect, what the bodybuilder must learn to do while he's training is shut off that ongoing conversation he carries with himself called his inner dialogue. I've seen inner dialogues get the best of many bodybuilders in the final weeks before a competition. They get so caught up in things to worry about that they experience unnecessary anxiety and stress and lose the contest. The capacity of the mind is fantastic if you know how to work with it. Now, I don't believe in constantly programming the mind. Many people use this approach in all areas of life. Essentially, it involves treating the mind like a computer and feeding it a program through suggestion or auto-suggestion, and then the program runs you. It drives you through your workout, oftentimes on nervous energy. My approach involves emptying the mind and then letting your training take its own course. When my mind is emptied, what's left is the space to create anything I want, and what I choose to create is a perfect body through fantastic workouts. I keep a training journal and I write in it after my workout, not during my workout. I follow basically the same workout program, but I prefer to let my body tell me how to train instead of programming myself. The body has an instinctive wisdom all its own. And by emptying the mind, I get in touch with this wisdom. It's worked exceedingly well for me. By keeping a workout journal, you have a record of what you did in your workout. This is invaluable to you the next time you decide to get into contest condition, and this is what I'm doing this year. Right now, I'm far ahead of where I was at the same time last year. Also, I know what I did wrong last year, and I won't repeat those mistakes this year. So by keeping the training journal, I become more conscious of all aspects of my workouts. Here is a page from my journal. This is part of a workout I did exactly 1 month before the Mr. Olympia contest last year. Body parts worked, back, chest, triceps, abs. Length of workout, 2.5 hours. Back, bent over rowing. 80, 100, 120, 140, 160, 170, 170 pounds, 10 reps per set. Leverage rowing, 115, 125, 135, 135 pounds, 10 reps per set. Dumbbell row, 90, 100, 110, 120-pound dumbbell, 8 to 10 reps per set. Close grip pull-down, 130, 130, 140 pounds, 10 reps each set. Front pull-down, 180, 190, 200, 210, 210, 8 to 10 rep per set. This is a total of 23 sets for back. Here's what I'm doing now 5 months before the big contest. Same body parts work, length of workout, 2 hours, 10 minutes. Back, bent over rowing, 125, 145, 165, 185, 195, 205, 8 to 10 reps per set. Leverage rowing, 115, 135, 145, 155, 10 reps each set. Seated two dumbbell rowing, four sets of 10 reps with 65 pound dumbbells. Dumbbell row, four sets of 10 with 90 pound dumbbells. Front pull down, 210, 220, 220, 220, 2 to 10 reps per set. Upside down rowing, one set of 12 reps with 100 pound barbell. This movement is done hanging from a bar by the feet held in a specially designed pair of boots. It's an excellent movement for the lower lats, and it gives much more needed traction to the spine. As a matter of fact, this exercise helped heal my lower back, which had given me trouble for many years. Notice the total is also 23 sets for back. Last year, I made a great improvement in my back development, and this year I'm handling even heavier weights in all back exercises except dumbbell rowing, which I only recently started doing. So you can see I'm way ahead of what I did last year. This program I do twice a week. In future articles, I will get into more of my workouts as I recorded them and what I'm doing now. By all means, I feel that as a bodybuilder, you should keep a journal and work on improving your concentration. All right, the end. That was interesting. I remember Zane was talking about that before, where he was talking about keeping track of his workouts and then comparing his workouts from one year to the next, and kind of gave him confidence knowing that he was doing more than he did last time. All right, let's read one more because it's getting kind of long here. This one is an article, a contest report article about Boyer Co. winning the first Grand Prix in Atlantic City. And this comes from September 1981 issue. And it's written by Chris Lund. "You flew in for the gambling, huh?" said the taxi driver as I loaded my suitcase and camera into his cab. "Gambling? No, thanks. I'm here for the bodybuilding," I replied, not having a clue what he was talking about. "A woman took $15,000 on the tables last night, and as she was waiting for them to make out the check, she pulled another $500 from the bandit," he rambled. "Is that right?" I say, still not knowing or caring a monkey's ass what he was talking about. After leaving the taxi behind, I walked into the foyer of the very plush and luxurious Resort International Hotel, which would be the venue of another IFBB first, a pro and amateur contest all in one. "Do you want to check in now, sir, or do you want to gamble first?" said a false and bored to tears looking young female sitting behind the desk. "Christ, do I look like Maverick or something?" I thought to myself. "No, I'm here for the bodybuilding," I replied. "Oh, the bodybuilding. That's tomorrow in the Superstar Theater, so you can book in now, sir," she replied in an even more false and bored tone. After a quick shower and change, I decided to give the hotel a once-over, and then it suddenly became apparent what this gambling talk was all about. Lined up and glittering in all their glory was a huge room packed with hundreds of gaming machines just waiting for the suckers to feed them. Yes, Atlantic City was the Las Vegas of the East Coast, but to hell with that, I was here for the bodybuilding. Entering the huge buffet room, I couldn't believe my eyes at the sight of all the food. Turkey, chicken, roast beef, cheese, all kinds of vegetables, fruits, and salads. You name it, it was there in abundance. As Bill Grant said, "There's so much food here, I don't know where to begin." Making my way around and round the table like a magpie, I bumped into Wayne D'Amelia, who had been booked by ABC Television to organize the contest for them. "Have you got some meal vouchers, Chris?" Wayne said. Well, not exactly," I mumbled. "Well, here are some for you. All competitors and officials and IFBB photographers' meals are being catered for," he said. "Fantastic. Can I stay for a month?" Seeing Tony Emmett and his girlfriend sitting with Samir Banood, I made my way over to them. "How's California, Tony?" I asked. "Great. How's Canada?" he replied. "Bloody freezing." As Tony and I exchanged stories, I could see Samir was having trouble with the very bossy waitress who had already given me some stick for sitting next to them. "Look, lady, if you keep on giving me a hard time, I'm just going to have to report you to management, okay?" snarled Samir in a dead serious tone of voice. Tony, trying desperately to keep the peace, said, "Samir, this is Chris Lund, the photographer from England." "Oh, yes, you wrote a very nice thing about me. You wrote that I could win the Olympia one day. That really made me train very hard, you know. Thank you for writing that," replied Samir. "Not at all. I still think you can win the Olympia. You got more potential than anybody," I said. "Thank you very much," said Samir. "So who came over from California for the contest, Tony? I know you didn't get very much advance notice that it was being held." "Yes, that's right. I only got to know a few weeks ago myself, so I'm not in very good shape. But Chris Dickerson's here, Boyer, Steve Davis, Bronson Austin, Dennis Tenorino, Bill Grant, and Clinton Barile," replied Tony. "Who else is entering?" I said. "Well, there's Al Beckles and Johnny Fuller from England, Don Modzelewski, Greg DeFaro, Charlie Thomas, and a young guy named Bill Register. Sounds great. Who's in top shape? I said. Boyer's looking fantastic, replied Tony. Yes, the shots I saw of him at the Olympia taken by John Bailick were unbelievable. He's very popular nowadays, isn't he? As if by a miraculous coincidence, Boyerko himself suddenly appeared at the table. Holding a plate of cold turkey, broccoli, and cranberry sauce, Boyer asked if he could join us. Boyer was still wearing his tracksuit bottoms and training shoes. I just come from a workout with Mike Mentzer. That's why I'm dressed like this, he told us. Around about 9 a.m. the next morning, I found myself back at the buffet table, and this time it was a choice between strawberries, grapefruit, peaches, pears, prunes, oranges, porridge, bacon, sausage, scrambled eggs, omelets, and pancakes, plus a whole lot more I can't even remember. Looking around the room, I could see Ben Weider sitting with Oscar State, obviously planning the day's events. Bill Pearl was sitting having breakfast with someone I couldn't put a name to. Rick Wayne, who was rumored to be returning to Joe Weider's Muscle and Fitness, was sitting talking to George Snyder, who was clutching a copy of Three More Reps, Book 3. Casting my eyes on the two friendly Canadian faces of photographer Gary Bartlett and top IFBB official Winston Roberts, I decided to have breakfast with them. Have you seen the list of all the IFBB Grand Prix contests to be held this year, Chris? Winston exclaimed. Yes, it's unbelievable. There should be some terrific contests, I replied. Well, apart from the New York Night of the Champions, May 9th, I'm holding a Grand Prix final in Montreal, too. After finishing my breakfast with Gary and Winston, I decided on a little nose around as the judging wasn't scheduled to start until 2 p.m. I noticed quite a few people going in and out of the room next to the buffet room, so I decided to investigate. Sitting at a table which was laid with eggs, cheese, and fruit, I saw Mike Mentzer. Mike was baking under the hot TV lights in the process of doing a program outlining his nutritional habits. I glanced over at the 12-inch color TV monitor to see how Mike was coming across. Wearing a tight, pale blue shirt, Mike looked great, and he gave a very thorough and meticulous interview, which will do bodybuilding proud. It was interesting to hear Mike state that before I became a professional bodybuilder, I would often eat large amounts of ice cream and even drink a full pack of beer straight after a contest. I needed to do this after I punished my body so hard with training and dieting. Now I watch what I eat all the time because of many different posing exhibitions throughout the year. When I asked what foods he ate, Mike replied, I prefer to eat lightly at all times, but I try to eat as many different foods as I can. This, of course, means good, wholesome, and natural foods. At 2 p.m. sharp, the great Superstar Theater was turned into a bodybuilding battleground, equipped with the now famous and traditional IFBB six-man posing platform. Because the contest was being sponsored by a TV company, I had mistakenly believed the lighting would be superb. It was superb for TV cameras, but for bodybuilding photography, the lighting was disastrous. It was quite unbelievable to watch exposure meters fly up to 125th at f5.6, almost the equivalent of an outdoor exposure on a sunny day, in England, that is. Yes, I'm afraid the lighting was far too bright, and almost all the competitors, with the exception of the black guys, found themselves smoothing out as soon as they stepped onto the posing platform. A very formidable lineup consisting of top pro and amateur bodybuilders took the stage in the following order. Albert Beckles from Britain, Don Modzelewski from the USA, Bill Register from the USA, Johnny Fuller from Britain, Steve Davis from the USA, Tony Emmett from Britain, Clinton Barile from the USA, Bronson Austin from the USA, Dennis Tinerino from the USA, Bill Grant from the USA, Charlie Thomas from the USA, Boyer Coe, and Greg DeFerro. As my eyes moved from left to right across the stage looking for a winner, I couldn't believe how massive and cut Boyer Coe looked. He looked a good winner to me, even then. Because of the large number of entrants, I'd like to level my comments to only the first six place winners. Sixth place and a check for $2,000 was Britain's Al Beckles. Al looked great from all angles and was just a shade down from his unbelievable condition at the Pro Mr. Universe in Columbus, Ohio last year. Fifth place and a check for $4,000 was a very popular Dennis Tinerino. As I watched Dennis through the viewfinder of my camera, I felt there was something missing from his usual condition. He lacked his usual unbelievably huge width and roundness, even though he was still in quite good shape. Dennis can still beat them all if he can put it all together. Fourth place and a check for $6,000 was current IFBB world champion Johnny Fuller from Britain. Johnny has literally come out of nowhere to beat the top bodybuilders at their own game. While he certainly doesn't have the world's most beautiful body, he does have a physique of unbelievable muscularity, thickness, and density. His leg development, including calves, are terrific, and they were probably the best in the entire contest. Look out for more of Johnny Fuller. Third place in a check for $8,000 was Bronson Austin. This was the first time I'd seen Bronson, and to say I was impressed would be a gross understatement. Bronson was easily the most muscular physique in the entire contest, and many thought he might be good enough to beat Chris Dickerson. Indeed, it was quite interesting to watch him and Chris pose side by side during the comparisons. The highlight of the whole day was to watch Bronson come on stage. Wearing the most amazing grin I've ever seen, Bronson entered the stage slow motion style. It was like watching a slow motion picture as Bronson edged ever so slowly across the stage to the platform. When he had finished his routine, he did exactly the same on his way back, and the packed house of 1,400 fans just loved it. Yes, Bronson Austin is the original slow motion man. Wishing to retain his full amateur status so he can compete in this year's Mr. America, Bronson donated his $8,000 check to the AAU fund, even though, as he told me later, I could do with the money. It's cost me almost twice that amount to get in shape for this contest, but I do want to win that Mr. America title. It's something you can keep for life. Bravo, Bronson Austin. Second place and a check for $10,000 was Chris Dickerson. I did not quite feel Chris was at his absolute very best, although he always does look sensational. He gave an absolute splendid posing routine, which must have taken many hours of practice and preparation. His unique posing routine almost brought the house down. In first place, in a check for $20,000, was the fabulous Boyer Coe. Boyer looked superb and, in my opinion, was a very easy winner. The judges must have thought so, too, because Boyer earned the remarkable and rather unbelievable perfect 20 out of 20 from every single judge during every single round. So with a perfect 300 total point score, a very delighted and grateful-looking Boyer accepted his check from the IFBB boss, Ben Weider. As my weekend trip was slowly coming to an end, I formed the opinion that Boyer Coe has now developed and earned a terrific amount of love and respect from those actively involved in the game, as well as the bodybuilders and fans themselves. Whether it's because many, many people feel that Boyer Coe is the uncrowned Mr. Olympia, or whether they just love the guy for his honest and modest manner on and off the stage, we'll probably never know. But one thing is for certain, Boyer Coe is going to take some beating this year. After all, he got the first one in Atlantic City. All right, that is it. Yeah, this was an interesting contest because Bronson Austin, as they mentioned, was an amateur who won the light heavyweight class the year before when Gary Leonard won the Mr. America. And back then, you had to go to the Mr. Universe and win the Mr. Universe in order to turn pro. So Bronson took second to Johnny Fuller from England, who was also in the show, and he took fourth. So they come into this contest in February, or whenever the contest was, early in the year of 1981, and Bronson beats Johnny Fuller, and he takes third place in this contest, and then he decides to not take his pro card, which was a mistake because he went into the Mr. America that year, and that was the year Tim Belknap won, and Rory Liedelmeyer took second. So I think Bronson was like third or fourth in the class. He didn't even win his class. So he never got a chance to go to the Mr. Universe again, and he never turned pro, where I believe if he would have accepted the money at this contest taking third, he would have gotten his pro card. So that was a bad move in retrospect on Bronson Austin's part. All right, guys, I'll save these other articles for later. I'm sure we'll have many opportunities to read more articles, and there's some great stuff from those Muscle Mag International. So what a great magazine. I'm glad I still got those old ones. And, of course, I'm sure you've heard some of my articles that I've read from Muscle Mag International, which I believe there was five of those, and those are classic magazines as well. But that is it for this week's show. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Hope we will be back next week with another show. Hopefully we'll get some guests sooner or later. And until then, I hope you guys train hard, stay safe, and we'll see you next week. Take care.